I've written reviews that are fairly serious, reviews that are fairly frivolous, and the critics that I like, I read them most of all as essayists, without really wanting to know if I should see the movie or not, because in most cases I have seen the movie, so I don't need to know the answer to that question.
Do you ever feel like you got it wrong? You know, if you see the movie a year later, or, you know, after you hear what other people have said about it, you realize you blew it?
That's the most common question that a movie critic gets after how many movies do you see in a week. Have you ever changed your mind on a movie? And I usually answer that question by saying, would that be wrong to do that? Or should one, having been a movie critic for 39 years, never have changed his mind ever? Obviously, over a period of time, the experiences in your life and the experiences you have at the movies allow you to bring something to a movie, let's say 20 years later or 10 years later, that you wouldn't bring or couldn't bring at the time you saw it in the first place. And so I'm sure that my opinions have broadened or deepened. I know when I saw Antonioni's The Passenger recently, I liked it a lot better than when I saw it for the first time. I know that I now think I understand Bergman's persona, and when I saw it in 1967, I do not think that I understood it. So, yeah, one hopes to be able to grow and learn, sure.
Well, I guess it also raises the question of whether what the critic is really doing is responding to the movie that very first time, if that's sort of what it's all about.
Well, I have an anthology coming out from the University of Chicago Press called Awake in the Dark, which is 40 years of my writings about the movies. And the editors of the press insisted, in most cases, in running my first review of a film, even if I had later gone back two or three times to write about it or had written about it in one of my great movies books, because they wanted to capture the feeling of when it was new. And in the case of reviews like 2001 and Bonnie and Clyde, it's a different kind of feeling, because you're writing about these films before they're masterpieces. In the case of 2001, I saw it at a press preview the night before its world premiere. And so I remember it was at the Pantages Theater on Hollywood Boulevard, and Rock Hudson walked out audibly saying, "Will somebody tell me what the hell this movie is about?" And I went back to the hotel and wrote my review, because everybody was very eager. This was the first public screening of the Kubrick film, and of course it had been publicized so widely. And I think that that review holds up, and it's not really remembered that today. People don't remember that most of the original reviews of 2001 were negative. So, the immediate experience, as Robert Warshaw called it, is important. How you felt the first time you saw it, when you knew nothing about it, and neither did anyone else.
I would think one of the obvious occupational hazards of being a movie critic is you just have to see a lot of junk. You have to wade through a lot of mediocre movies. Does that ever get you down?
No, because I enjoy writing reviews of bad movies. And look at it this way. If you had to see a bad movie, it would be 2 hours of your life that you would resent because you had lost them and wasted them. I'm paid to be there. I got in free. And I get to write a review about it, in which I get my revenge. As I was watching Deuce Bigalow, European Gigolo, I was not suffering, because with every additional awful moment that went past, I was busily taking notes for my review.
So the worse it is, the more license you have to rip it apart.
In a sense, yeah. Some movies, I think a crime that's worse than badness is boring. If a movie is boring, then then it's tough, you know. But if it's bad but interesting in a bad way, like Basic Instinct 2, then in that case you're kind of grateful.
But then you get into the murky area of, I would think, of, say, independent movies, you know, not the big Hollywood movie, but the movie that's trying to make it, that has good intentions, doesn't quite pull it off. You know, how cruel are you going to be there?
Well, what you try to do in a review of a movie that will not get very much play is, first of all, you want to be descriptive, because this movie does not have an advertising campaign and people on the morning talk shows behind it. And then, well, for example, on our show, our television show, which is quite a different enterprise from print criticism, we generally will not review a small film that's going to get two thumbs down, because why go out of our way to attack a film that most people couldn't see anyway and that we don't think they should see. So generally speaking, if it's an independent film, documentary, foreign film, it has one thumb up or two thumbs up.
Do you know that ahead of time, though?
The producers do. We don't know what the other person thinks. I know what my thumb is, you know. But so that, of course, if my thumb is down, then Richard's must be up or we wouldn't be doing it. So I know it to that degree. Yeah, you can figure that out. But in print, I review most everything that I can. I do about 280 movie reviews a year.
280 movie reviews a year?
Yeah.
It's almost one every day.
Well, I have 8 coming out next Friday. And I like to write a lot of movie reviews because I enjoy writing.
You must be very fast.
I'm fast, but I'm not that fast. It takes some time.
How long do you figure a typical review takes you to write?
Some reviews take typing speed. Others can take...
Typing speed?
Yeah. I've written reviews at typing speed. I've also written reviews that took a couple of hours and then let them rest on the hard drive and go back at them tomorrow and look at them again. And
you're saying you can write some reviews that would 5 minutes or something like that?
Oh, no, typing speed would still be longer than 5 minutes, I'm sure.
Okay. Wow, I'm impressed.
I'm not going to tell you that I've written very many reviews at typing speed, but there are some that simply just seem to come out. They're just there in your mind. Hmm. A few.
Like, give me an example of one of those.
Well, for example, Deuce Bigelow, European Gigolo. If you read that review, it would seem as if I am riffing. But actually, I had an agenda before I sat down. First of all, I went to see the movie, and it was very, very bad. I knew that Rob Schneider, the star and begetter of the film, had taken a full-page ad in the L.A. Times to attack one of their writers, who had said, at Oscar season, why is it that none of the 5 Oscar nominees for Best Picture could find big studio backing, but they will back a picture like Deuce Bigelow, European Gigolo? So Rob, in his full-page ad, said, you don't have the qualifications to review my film. You haven't won any awards. You don't have a Pulitzer Prize, blah, blah, blah. So somehow my fingers just automatically got into discussing this ad, and then I said, but hey, wait a minute. I do have a Pulitzer Prize. So I am qualified to review your movie, Mr. Schneider, and it sucks. Well, something like that, it just is never going to get any better. You're not going to rewrite that because it's just perfect the way it is. And I won the Pulitzer Prize in 1975, and I've never referred to myself in print as having won it until that review, 31 years later, because suddenly there was an occasion when it was totally appropriate.
So it felt good to
write
that review.
Yes, it did. It felt good because not only did he make a very bad movie, but he had the insufferable gall to insult somebody who, in fact, had won a lot of prizes, for that matter.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any guilty pleasures about particular kinds of movies? I mean, movies that probably in some objective sense are not that great, but you just really like them.
You know, it's interesting you should mention that because when I saw Basic Instinct 2 with Sharon Stone, I knew that it was a bad movie, and it is a bad movie. But I found myself extremely conflicted about it because it was not boring and it was often awful in extremely engaging ways. I think I said that the role could not be played well, but nobody could play it badly better than Sharon Stone. And I gave it 1.5 stars, and I kind of had a funny little footnote saying that I gave it 1.5 stars, sort of like a cold shower to keep myself from giving it 4 stars. There are movies that, in a review like that, what I'm trying to tell the reader is, look, it's bad, we all know it's bad, but of the bad movies that are out there, this one is probably going to entertain you more than most of the others. And I don't know what that would be called, slumming, or I don't even like that word, but there's a certain gratitude you have for some kinds of movies that are awful in grandiose or ambitious ways instead of just simply awful through stupidity and lack of any attempt to do anything.
Mm-hmm. Let me. When I originally went to see Dumb and Dumber, the person I went to see it with, she was laughing throughout much of the movie, and then when it ended, she said, "That was a really stupid movie."
Yeah, you know.
And I sort of said, "How can you say it's bad if you were laughing during it?"
I think I gave it a negative review, something like 2.5 stars or 2 stars, and yet the scene where the blind boy realizes that his parakeet's head has been scotch-taped onto the body, I'm still laughing now when I think about it. And maybe I should have given that movie a favorable review. Because then another movie, There's Something About Mary. Mm-hmm. That movie has 6 of the biggest laughs I've ever had in a theater.
With the dogs.
And they are separated by just about nothing.
Yeah.
It's just dead space, enormous laugh. Dead space, enormous laugh. Now, a perfect comedy like the original 1967 or 8 Mel Brooks producers, the whole movie is great. And you can't say that about There's Something About Mary. But then on the other hand, when you're laughing, you are really, really laughing. And that's, you know, humor cannot be faked. Either you're laughing or you're not laughing. Mm-hmm. And you can't lie about that.
So as a critic, what do you say about a movie?
I gave it a favorable review. Mm-hmm. While saying that, you know, it's pretty dead in between the laughs, but maybe the dead spaces are just building up to the next laugh in a way, although they're not really very well handled, but the laughs are well handled. You know, it's rare enough to find a perfect movie.
Have there been any perfect movies?
Yeah, there have been some perfect movies. McCabe and Mrs. Miller is a perfect movie by Robert Altman. Mm-hmm. It's a perfect movie. There is nothing wrong with it. Everything is right about it. Every shot, every moment, everything in that movie. It's just a wonderful film. It's perfect. It is the best McCabe and Mrs. Miller that could possibly be.
Hmm. So in other words, when you say that, you're saying that you couldn't imagine a different shot that would be any better or sort of changing the narrative
theory,
line or anything like
theory,
that.
In theory, he could have put his camera somewhere else. Mm-hmm. He could have changed the line of dialogue. He did. I mean, you know, when he makes movies, when anybody makes movies, on the set that day, there might be an accident that leads to the camera being in one place instead of another or a sudden inspiration so that there could be other different perfect McCabe and Mrs. Millers. You know, in an alternative universe, there could be an unlimited number of perfect McCabe and Mrs. Millers. But in this universe, that movie is perfect. And I can think of some others. O Hazard Balthazar by Bresson, the story of a donkey, is a perfect film. 2001, in its own way, is a perfect film.
Which is interesting because it's... Do you still think it is? Have you seen it recently?
Oh, I think I've seen it many times, including quite recently.
And it doesn't seem too slow to you?
No. In fact, when I saw it at the world premiere, it was slower because, you know, he cut out a couple of repetitive scenes. There was a whole sequence of the pod rotating and leaving the mothership and going into space was almost exactly the duplicate of another scene where the pod does the same thing. And he took out the second rotation, took out the entire sequence. He was editing all the way. He wouldn't fly, Kubrick, and so he was editing all the way across the ocean on the QE2 and then all the way across America on a train and then into an editing room, and then the print was taken dripping wet to the theater and another print was sent to Washington. And he said, "I'm not finished. I have to take some more out," and he did. So it wasn't perfect when it premiered. But so it's slow. I mean, in my opinion, no good movie is slow, and no bad movie can be fast enough, you know. So, slowness to me is not a negative term. It's just a descriptive term.
Mm-hmm. As long as it holds your attention.
Yeah. Well, 2001 does.
Right.
It's sad in a way that so few people have had an opportunity to see it in 70 millimeter. Although now IMAX theaters occasionally are showing films on their big screens, and that's a good way to see it. Because 2001 or Lawrence of Arabia, movies like that, simply cannot exist on your home TV screen.
That's true. I tried renting Lawrence of Arabia a few years ago. It was just dead.
You have to see it. I have this Overlook Film Festival at the University of Illinois, and we always start on the opening night with a 70 millimeter film. Over the years, we've shown Playtime by Tati and Patton and and 2001. And this year we're going to show My Fair Lady in 70 millimeter. You know, 70 millimeter is so good, and so few people have had an opportunity to see it. It's a shame that, Hollywood at one time was so concerned with this superb idea of projection quality and has now backed away from it into the multiplex mediocrity of just routine projection, oftentimes with the lamp turned down too low. You know, this is a national scandal that theater chains, despite being specifically informed by Eastman Kodak that this is not true, turn down the intensity of the projector lamp, thinking they can extend the life of the expensive bulb in there, and it doesn't have any effect on the life at all. So that oftentimes audiences are seeing pictures that are dim because they're not being shown at the at a high enough lamp level.
And there must not be many theaters that have 70 millimeter screens, I would guess.
No longer, no. No. They're tearing down a lot of the theaters with screens big enough to make 70 millimeter appropriate. And that's why, in a way, IMAX is a godsend, because that does have a big screen. A lot of the big movie palaces, and at my Overlook Film Festival in Champaign-Urbana, we have a classic old movie palace with 1,600 seats and a vast screen. But, you know, if you're just in a multiplex with 300 seats, then what's the point?
Yeah. Now, when you look back over the history of film criticism, who are the critics who stand out to you?
Well, the critic that was most important to me was Dwight MacDonald, who worked for Esquire in the 50s when I was in high school. And by reading his column, I became aware of what film criticism could be, or indeed that it existed. And it changed the way I looked at movies. I think that, like most people in downstate Illinois, and when I was 14 or 15, I just went to the movie and looked at it and left. And it was MacDonald's example that led me to the art theater in town to begin to see Fellini and Bergman and the British directors.
Which is interesting, because I think Dwight MacDonald is probably best known for his political writing, or writing about books, or not so much as a movie critic.
That's right, but he was the film critic for Esquire, and he finally quit after 8 and a half. He said, 8 and a half is a perfect film. I've seen so many bad films, I'm going to quit now. And he quit. So, and 8 and a half was an awfully good film. So, and for that matter, I think Fellini's La Dolce Vita is a perfect film.
So what about Dwight MacDonald? What about his criticism?
You see, it wasn't important to me what he said. It was important to me that he said it and how he said it. I liked his style. I liked the way he wrote. I liked his scorn or his passion. It was the example that he was setting, which is to say, you can go to the movies and you can think about them really hard and write about them in sharp-edged prose, and express your opinion strongly. That was because I was just a kid. I was a teenager. And so it was the example. It wasn't that I was learning something in an abstract way that I could use. It was that I was learning in a concrete way. And so I started, when I got to college, to write a weekly column for the student paper, which was first person. I mean, I had worked for the local newspaper in high school as a journalist, the real newspaper. I was not, by the way, an intern. I was a real reporter, because they didn't have money for interns. But it was through the example of MacDonald and other people who were writing in those kinds of magazines at that time. Norman Mailer. I remember advertisements for myself. A collection of his personal essays came out while I was in high school, and I read that from cover to cover. Gore Vidal. These people inspired me, or taught me, or pointed me toward first-person personal essays. And even today I get emails from people telling me I should be more subjective in my reviews. And of course, a critic should never be subjective, objective. A critic should be subjective. I think I got that the wrong way around, but you know what I'm trying to say.
What about Pauline Kael? Was she a great critic?
She was a fabulous writer. And she was... her passion was an example. I was friendly with Pauline. I met her at the 1967 New York Film Festival, which is before she went to work for The New Yorker. And we stayed in touch over the years. And her influence was more personal in that she had a very visceral, immediate, gutsy reaction to movies.
And of course, she's famous for celebrating trashy, what some people would call trashy movies, well, if they had vibrancy.
She pointed out that the movies are so seldom great art that unless we can appreciate great trash, we have no reason to go. And she would like, for example, her ideas of trash, though, were pretty high class. She liked Brian De Palma's early films. You know, that not exactly, I mean, there's trash and then there's trash.
Mm-hmm. Or hyper-violent.
Yeah, so that maybe his movie like The Fury might be trash, but it might be, you know, mm-hmm. pretty good film. So I don't think she was saying, well, we have to like Deuce Bigelow, for example.
Right. Now, I think some people would say that there have been a few critics, maybe Pauline Kael was one of them, who actually changed the way we thought about movies. I mean, sort of who elevated the respect for certain kinds of movies that were just dismissed before.
Well, what happened in the 1960s was that film criticism as a profession and film critics as people became visible in popular culture for the first time. There were important critics before the 60s. I mentioned Dwight MacDonald. Go all the way back to Vachel Lindsay, who wrote an important book about film. Carl Sandburg wrote for 9 years for the Chicago Daily News movie reviews. You had James Agee, you had Manny Farber, Otis Ferguson, Stanley Kaufman, been writing since the 50s for the New Republic and is still writing there and is really the critic that I really admire the most among active critics right now. But it was with the banning of Judith Crist, 20th Century Fox banned her from their screenings after she attacked Cleopatra in the New York Herald Tribune. And that made for a lot of publicity. And suddenly, Judith Crist was famous. She went on the Today Show. And papers around the country who had been, you know, their film critics were just a house pseudonym. Like at the Tribune in Chicago, it was Matinee, which was kind of like matinee. And it could be anybody writing that review. And suddenly, papers began to feel, well, we better get our own critic who really is reviewing the movies. And so that was important. And then Kael got a lot of publicity, and Saris. And
Do you think they did change the way people thought about movies, or maybe even the way some filmmakers made movies?
Well, popular magazines and newspapers began to devote a great deal of wordage to film reviews that they had not done before. So, yes, there was a whole resurgence. There was what happened in the 60s actually began in 1959 and 1960 with the birth of the French New Wave and also with the simultaneous birth of American independent filmmaking through John Cassavetes in particular and then the whole new American cinema, so that you got a new kind of film, a personal film that was liberated from the studio system. And these films at first were under the radar, and then they began to get a lot of attention. And so that by the mid-60s, it was time or past time for Hollywood, for America, to begin to develop a cinema like this. And we began to get films like Bonnie and Clyde and Easy Rider and Midnight Cowboy that were quite outside the boundaries of an accepted studio film. And the people who went to see them and the people who wrote about them were also outside the boundaries of traditional audiences and traditional publicity about show business. So that happened during the 60s, and it was kind of consolidated. There's been some backsliding since then. Today, most of the coverage of movies in the mass media is simply promotional and celebrity-driven. Nothing amuses me more than these infotainment shows. We've got the first look at the trailer for The Matrix, you know, and then they interview the stars and they visit the set, but they never tell you what they think about the movie. You know, they will tell you everything about the premiere and what people wore and who was there and how much the movie cost and what happened on the location.
They don't want to bite the hand that
feeds them. But they will not say if they liked it or not, because what they are doing essentially is using their access to this material to put their shows together.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an interesting question about how influential a movie reviewer can be today. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that you are the most influential film critic in America. But do you think you have the power to make or break a movie?
I don't know. I know that film critics have been able to literally save certain independent films. Monster, for example. Roper and I went 3 weeks early with our review of that. We saw it, we were blown away. And apparently, as a result of our review, they decided to go wider with it in their initial release. They were thinking of 4 or 5 theaters in 4 or 5 cities and then straight to DVD.
Hmm.
They had no idea that it was going to be an Academy Award contender. So I think we were able to affect its destiny. Movies like One False Move, My Dinner with Andre, other films that critics in general have been able to help.
Is that what you feel best about, when you can kind of...
Well, I'd like to have a lot more power than I do have.
Uh-huh. But, I mean, those sort of small movies that then through
yes.
good word of mouth early on can make it.
When you meet a new director, meet a person like... meet him on the screen, I mean, like John Singleton with Boys in the Hood, or Spike Lee with Do the Right Thing, or Scorsese, or David Gordon Green, who's George Washington, and later films are just, you know, David Gordon Green is only 30 now, and he's just about, he's the best of his generation. He makes great movies. And when you see a movie by somebody like that, you truly get excited. There's a guy named Eric Beiler who's made a couple of movies, Americanese and Charlotte Sometimes. I think he has a terrific future. When you see the first films by people like Todd Haynes, Paul Thomas Anderson, this is really an interesting experience for you. But one thing that was interesting that I read just this week that went against what I thought was probably true, Nielsen did a survey of moviegoers and asked them how they made up their mind about what movies to go to. And a majority of them, the largest group of moviegoers responding to the survey, said they became aware of a movie through the advertising and made up their mind after reading a review in the newspaper.
Hmm.
And, of course, the conventional wisdom is all about ads and about the Internet.
And television, too.
And TV, yeah. And to think that newspaper print reviews were the number one source for their decision-making was startling.
Must have made you feel good.
And it was Nielsen who did that, and they did it, you know, it wasn't being paid by the Newspaper Publishers Association. They were just doing it for some reason. So I read that, and I forwarded it by email to a lot of other people saying, who would have thought?
Is this a good time to be a movie critic right now?
Well, it's a good time every time you see a good movie. In my career, I've had a lot of moments when you go into a theater expecting nothing or not knowing what to expect and come out having seen a great film. Oddly enough, Gene Siskel and I had just come back from vacation and walked in on Monday morning to a 10 o'clock movie called Fargo that neither one of us knew anything about. And we didn't even know it was directed by the Coen brothers, and their credit isn't until the end.
Hmm.
Although you might have guessed that it was.
That's interesting. I guess I would have assumed that, you know, you'd get the press packet.
No, we try. I try not to follow. I don't read that stuff. I don't like to look at trailers or read the press booklets. I'd rather go in cold if I can. At Sundance last year, a year ago, I took the wrong shuttle bus. You know, it's 10 o'clock at night and there's a blizzard and you're standing in the cold and you want to go over to the public library to see a film, but you take the wrong bus and it takes you to the Yarrow Inn. And it's just too damn cold to wait outside any longer. So you go inside and some kid from San Diego State says, are you here to see Miranda July's film? And you say, no. And he says, oh, you ought to see it. It's really good. And so I said, okay, I will. I didn't know who Miranda July was. I walked in and I saw Me and You and Everybody We Know. And it was the best film I saw at the festival.
Hmm.
And Junebug is another movie like that. And so when you stumble upon a film like this from out of left field, it's such a great experience. When I saw Monster, I expected nothing. And I had no idea that was Charlize Theron, and I never did until the final credits, because I hadn't read the publicity. And I don't believe anyone who said they recognized her. And what a great movie that was. A Monster's Ball, too, you know, which I didn't expect was going to be anywhere near that good. And I was blown away by that. Million Dollar Baby. Clint Eastwood made that movie with no advance publicity, no interviews on the set, no infotainment profiles, nothing. I received a call. They're going to screen Clint Eastwood's new film. It's called Million Dollar Baby. It's going to be at 10 o'clock on Monday. And I walked into it, and I walked out, and I knew that I had seen that year's Oscar winner. I just knew it. And at that moment, everybody in the world thought The Aviator by Scorsese would win the Oscar that year. And the moment that Million Dollar Baby started to play, I knew that the field had changed. But I had no idea what to expect. I did not know it was a boxing movie.
I'm amazed that that's, I guess I just, I would have assumed that, someone in your position would kind of know all the buzz.
No, I try to avoid the buzz. You know, you can go online and there are sites where you can actually read early drafts of the screenplay and hear all about fights on the set and whether the director's cut is going to make it through and what Harvey is doing, you know, to some poor director. And I'm not interested in that. I want to go in, sit down, and look at the movie. Afterwards, I might want to, you know, find out more about it, sure.